The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you know, it seems that no matter how much I study monetary history or the markets, I'm having to broaden my scope. I mean, in the old days, you could look at U.S. history, you could see what the Federal Reserve did, or you could look at markets in a, you know, 1 or 2 year time frame, and you could say, all right, well, I think I have enough data to continue. But at this point, you have to broaden your historic understanding. You have to broaden, actually, your international understanding to have any idea what effect it'll have on your assets.
It's a good time for people to be asking the question, what grasp do I have of monetary history? Because for anyone paying attention to the events that are happening right now, this week in the last 10 days, we are hurtling towards a monetary disaster. And we'll get to this shortly. But what is different this time than in the past? Really, it is that we don't have the limitations. We have no machinery to be concerned about. Actual printing presses involved in adding electronic zeros.
Well, and you know what I was talking about, David, is the actions of Japan. Most people don't pay any attention to Japan. In fact, Japan has sort of gotten to be quietly just out of sight, out of mind, because for the last 20 years or so, they've just been in a quiet sort of depression, recession. There no real inflation. They haven't really participated. But now, it seems that they're trying to imitate the Federal Reserve and print a lot of money.
3 to 4 months ago, we looked at Abenomics and the idea that Shinzo Abe, the new leader of Japan, was going to, this month, replace the Bank of Japan chief. And we've just, in the last 3-4 weeks, figured out what not just the talk will be, but what the action will be by the Bank of Japan. And this is what happened last week. The increase of the Bank of Japan balance sheet by over 100% over the next 2 years.
That's amazing. They're trying to double their balance sheet in 2 years.
Well, and we'll get into some of the details on this, but how and why does this matter to the gold investor? As the world central banks have increased the size of their balance sheets, buying assets and putting money into the banking system thereby, we've seen over the last 12 to 13 years the price of gold rise in lockstep with that increase in sort of balance sheet footprint, if you will. You can see the trend going back to the year 2000, and we're talking here about the collective assets between Japan, the UK, Europe, US. It started at just over $2 trillion. It's risen to just over $9 trillion more recently. And gold in that time frame has simply measured the degree to which the major world currencies have been debased.
That is amazing. You know, if you think about gold coming up about between four and a half and five fold during that period of time, we're talking almost dollar for dollar how much the monetary base has increased.
Again, we're looking at the collective increase of the world central banks increasing their footprint, buying assets and putting that money into the banking system. Every $1 trillion increase has increased the price of gold on average by about $200 to $210. As Eric Sprott has been keen to point out, this collective increase in liquidity is not likely to change anytime soon. If you're looking at last week's Bank of Japan commitment, you're talking about a $75 billion per month asset purchase. Now,
so this is similar to the Federal Reserve. We're saying $85 billion. They're saying $75 billion. You put that together, I mean, that's a lot of money.
You're coming up on $2 trillion worth of an increase over the next 12 months. Now, we are talking about an economy that is much, much smaller than ours. So while we're increasing our balance sheet by $1 trillion this year, they're going to basically do the very same thing, just shy of it, and in a much smaller economy. So the inflationary, price inflationary impact within Japan is something definitely to ponder. But we also have the Bank of England chief, the brand new Bank of England chief, Carney, who moved over from Canada. He may do the same thing. It's really only the European Central Bank, which remains in question as to how much or if they will increase their balance sheet.
This is like a race to the bottom, Dave. I mean, as far as values and currencies, they can't continue to do this without ruining the currency of the world.
Well, a number of large European banks have argued that gold is going to witness a precipitous decline, that we've moved into a new bear market in gold, et cetera, et cetera. And yet what they're ignoring is basically the facts. We have a $400 to $420 price that is likely to be added to current levels, which would take us to the old highs at around 1920. And as we discussed last week, the U.S. Fed has spent the last 18 months doing little while doing a lot of talking.
Sure.
Now they're doing the opposite. The latest numbers show that they're back in the expansion mode, and gold will reflect the aggregate expansion, not just the Fed, but the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, as they expand or contract in unison. And for now, it appears that the correction in gold is over. Prices are moving higher. Over the next several months, we'll see those prices get in line with the aggressive monetary policies now so common in practice.
Well, and it's amazing to see how we're trying to be manipulated, Dave, as far as perception goes. You know, we're talking propaganda coming out from the top level guys like George Soros. You know, these guys who are pulled out of the closet anytime they need to be pulled out to perform their Jedi mind tricks and say, gold is going down. We're printing money, but gold is going down.
You will not need this asset class. As I surreptitiously buy my own ounces, you will think about other things and dream bigger dreams.
So, no, well, here's the thing, though, Dave. They have told us that we have no inflation, but that's changing. They're
right.
Starting to say, you also will like inflation.
Right.
Inflation's good for you.
Well, and we have entered into the publicly disclosed phase of inflation. Up until now, there's been some attempt at downplaying inflation. Although monetary policies have been very interventionist, the inflationary effects have been purposefully downplayed. The PR machine has basically said that there's no inflationary concerns. To use Bernanke's classic, I mean, how often does he repeat this? Inflation remains
well anchored. Yes.
Yeah. Now the game is becoming less subtle. We will print, we will inflate, and you will change your consumption, savings, and investment behavioral patterns or pay the price. The new message is, I think, very clear. The middle class and those living on a fixed income had better prepare for the worst. And, of course, those with assets will likewise need to or should be shifting their allocations. Now, where is the key question?
Well, and, you know, we're talking about the Japanese have not really experienced inflation in the last 20 years. So everyone, not just the United States, but everyone is going to have to change their investment habits because, David, at this point, they're going to have to protect themselves from inflation.
Well, and you have to subtly distinguish between what the intended destination of your assets is versus where you should more prudently be investing your assets. This is designed. This is designed to get you out of your bank deposits. This is designed to scare you out of a cash position. This is designed to stimulate velocity of money and create, again, a better economic engine, if you will, or to essentially jumpstart the economic engine.
Well, David, this is what's interesting. The central banks are printing money to try to increase growth, okay? The problem is the Japanese companies are not buying into this at this point. They're saying, we're not really seeing the growth. We're not going to actually increase.
This is where economic realities meet monetary ones. You've got 85% of Japanese companies which plan to either keep wages flat or actually reduce them this year.
Right.
You've had factory output, which fell. This is Japanese factory output, fell in February with a still very sluggish Chinese economy affecting Japanese business leaders' sentiment. This poses a challenge for both Shinzo Abe and his central bank president, Kuroda. As inflation is intentionally being put into the system, they're expecting there to be a rise in wages, and it's not going to happen. So, you know, what do you have here? I mean, the hope is that you go from deflation to a mild form of inflation, something that's very controlled. But what if instead you merely shift from deflation? Again, that's not all bad. When you look at savings, buying more,
you get to buy more with your money. That's a good thing.
But what if you shift from deflation to stagflation, wherein you have economic activity that remains stagnant along with wages while the prices of things are going up? Now, this is a very real possibility in Japan.
Okay, well, David, we've talked about Federal Reserve policies always looking also towards the full employment model, trying to get everybody employed. But actually, this could increase unemployment, not decrease unemployment.
Sure, if there's political pressure on the business community in Japan to raise wages, what you're likely to see is a very reasonable unemployment rate, right around 4.3%. You're likely to see that rise in Japan. Again, that's not a positive outcome, but add to a stagnant real wage environment the notorious aging demographics in Japan, where more and more people are dependent on their savings to make ends meet, and this could be a disaster for an aging Japanese population. Again, unable to meet the rising costs except by radically increasing risk in their investment portfolios. So here again, you're seeing a central bank push the issue of, if you're not going to free up those deposits, we're going to force the issue, and you will be taking greater risk just to make ends meet. So in an attempt to revive the economy, you could very well create greater social anxiety and even dislocation, social dislocation. I mean, in any event, it appears to us that capital is going to massively shift from the private holdings of Japanese government bonds to the Bank of Japan balance sheet. And again, you have an exit which will either take money into fixed income markets ex-Japan, you know, again, that could be Europe, or stocks, or they could literally exit Japan altogether. That's not the aim of the Bank of Japan, but you could have that happen too.
Well, and David, I think what we're seeing, similar to Stockman, what he's been talking about, is this is the end of Keynesian economics. We're seeing last-ditch efforts of the only model they have is to print money and keep interest rates abnormally low. The problem is they're not seeing the results that John Maynard Keynes had predicted.
Right. So inflating a currency puts a subtle pressure on individual savers and business managers alike to release caches of currency or cash back into the economy rather than keeping them as sort of a war chest.
Which is a Keynesian goal.
Right, right. Rather than have them sidelined as a reserve, the challenge is that in a globalized world, you can create the pressure and you may inadvertently stimulate capital flight. I mean, just because you want to force something out of the bank and into the economy, it may literally leapfrog your economy and go elsewhere.
Right.
Because again, if risk and reward are not in balance, the market is fairly reasonable. So I mean, we may be looking at sort of a 3-year period in here where we see not only massive stimulus from the world's central banks, but then coping with the unintended consequences, the need to raise capital controls to make sure that you don't, on the one hand, solve a problem, quote unquote, and on the other, create a new one, which is get rid of your deposits altogether.
Well, and David, we're reading Stockman's book right now, and he talks about how Keynesianism only works in a closed system. So this is exactly what you're talking about. If you had a closed system and nobody could exit the system, what you would have is you would have the ability to control the economy, at least to a degree, based on theory. But of course, what you're saying is that money will flee until the capital controls come in and lock it down.
And, you know, in the days immediately following the Bank of Japan announcement, so this is last Friday and this week's Monday, the stock exchange had to temporarily halt. We're talking about the Tokyo Stock Exchange had to temporarily halt trading of Japanese government bonds
due
to volatility.
They were losing control.
Now, I mean,
yeah.
Think of this. This is absolutely, of course, these are just numbers that for most people don't matter, but listen to this. You had yields on Japanese government bonds swing from a 32 basis point yield up to as high as a 65 basis point yield. And again, you're talking about a doubling.
Yeah.
You're talking about a doubling in yield. And this was not the intended consequence of the announcement of quantitative easing, this massive money printing effort. I mean, again, when the government is saying we're going to buy Japanese government bonds, what that should ordinarily do is not only cap rates, but bring them down. The fact that you're seeing yields blow out says that there's a lot of uncertainty as to the stability of the Japanese government bond market, and it may be too large an issue for the Bank of Japan to even handle. So what that would imply, and of course this is just one day, and one day does not make a trend, but what that would imply is that there's enough operators in the Japanese government bond market who would say, listen, we're out completely, and we don't like the smell of this. This could spell the collapse of the Japanese government bond market. Again, you just don't see that kind of volatility in a market that is supposedly as liquid as the Japanese government
bond.
Well,
and there are strange after effects of these changes, you know, these policy changes. All of a sudden, it starts to affect the European bond yields and,
well,
you know,
sure,
the values of European bonds. Why is that?
Particularly last week, you saw European government bonds. Again, there was a massive influx of buying. Yields came down, prices went up. Where did the money come from? You've got the exit on the Japanese government bonds and the entrance. Again, this is investors being forced out of positions they've been happy to hold with the idea that if you're going to inflate away our purchasing power, then low to zero rates in the government bonds that we have in Japan won't be sufficient to cover our income needs. Therefore, we've got to find a higher level of income. So where do they go? Japanese government bonds to Italian, to Hungarian. I mean, this is an amazing
Greek
thing. To Greek. I mean, literally, you're driving money completely out of the Japanese system. Is that really what the Bank of Japan wanted? Now, I mean, to some degree, that's welcome, because when you exit the yen investments, you are boosting the value of the euro and euro area bonds, and so you're receiving sort of a relative benefit. Again, the yen is weakening, and of course, a weakening yen is exactly what the Bank of Japan wants as a part of its 2% inflation target gambit.
Well, you know, it's amazing. Central banks, then, they have control over printing money, but they don't necessarily have control over the consequences, or the, you know, the unintended consequences, which even go beyond that.
Well, and it's really what you're talking about is a bubble dynamic which is created. You can create liquidity, but you can't necessarily direct its flow. What you're creating is unhealthy capital allocation. That's the real result. When prices are distorted in one arena, then you begin to see spillover effects into other asset classes. That's what drove European bond yields lower, as we were just talking about a minute ago, and prices higher last week.
So the Europeans are saying thank you very much in Japanese at this
point. Arigato. Arigato. Thank you very much. You know, we see the same issue in the current U.S. real estate market. Just to switch gears here and by analogy, we see the same issue in the U.S. real estate market with the Fed driving mortgage rates lower via the Fed purchases of mortgage-backed securities. And then, of course, you have the opportunity, once they've gotten the system dependent on their purchases, the mere suggestion of eliminating the market subsidy takes anyone who's sitting on the fence, it takes them off the fence and gets them into the market.
Right.
Because what happens if they stop buying mortgage-backed securities? Well, mortgage rates will go higher. It means you may not be able to afford the house that you've been looking at on Zillow or on whatever your favorite real estate website is. You may not be able to afford it. Your current income won't allow it. You better get off the dime and buy that house right now. I mean, so this is the ability of central bankers to manipulate crowd behavior.
So they don't even have to do it. They can just threaten doing it. They can say, you know, we may let interest rates rise a little bit. You better get your mortgage done.
It's not that the Fed has to or will quit, but they can further badger the reluctant real estate buyer into concerns over, again, what we talked about last week, cash flow affordability. That's really what we're talking about, is affordability, not because real estate prices can't go lower in nominal terms, but in terms of affordability, in terms of cash flow affordability,
sure.
That's what people are afraid of missing out
people
on.
People are saying, if I don't lock these low rates in now, I'm not going to ever be able to buy a home.
Or a condo, or whatever you may have. So, in essence, the mention of ending QE is a scare tactic to get people to do something else with their money, to dishoard their savings. Again, that's a very strong Keynesian thematic in terms of how you manipulate the market and market participants' behavior.
It's amazing to me to see how governments are starting to use market psychology. That's what this really is. I mean, the psychology of forcing people to buy a home, the psychology of getting Japanese people to actually do something now that they're printing money. But you know what I'm thinking, Dave, is the Japanese experience of investing is going to change, because they now have to understand how to hedge their own buying power of their savings. And they haven't had to do that in the last 20 years.
This is a radical shift. It's not just in terms of monetary policy, but it's also investor behavior. And yes, if you now know that inflation is a threat, and it hasn't been in your investment experience for the last 10, 20, 30 years, then yes, an era is passing. One of the largest groups of savers in the world is Japanese savers.
Right.
And over the next 2 years, they're going to be pressured with sort of a neo-Keynesian cattle prod.
Well, their monetary base is going to be doubled.
Right, right. Which means they're either going to spend their savings or move on to other assets, which have a greater risk profile, but do give them the income they need to meet the inflationary concerns that they now have. You know, again, lest what they have becomes worth less and less each year.
Right.
So where are those savings going to go? I mean, only time will tell, but we know that we'll see a trickle into the Nikkei. I mean, listen, since November, the Nikkei is up 40%.
Right.
And this is just with Abe's suggestion of bringing in someone like Kuruda to do exactly what he just announced last week.
You pointed this out last week. A little bit of inflation is good for the equities market. A lot of inflation is devastating for the equities market.
But we're also seeing a trickle going into foreign government bonds in Europe. Mm-hmm. Treasury yields have come down in the last few days. And at least a trickle will go into gold. I mean, we've had pension fund managers in Japan say, listen, if this is going to be an inflationary trend, we're going to have to increase our allocation to gold. You know, so this is, again, dealing with creating an antidote to central bank shredding of a currency, in this case, the yen.
Well, David, I know this week you're going to be with some top thinkers. You do this every year, and you're going to be near and talking to David Stockman, who He's been very outspoken about these incredible policies and what they're actually going to do to the little guy.
Well, it's the Bank of Japan that's in our sights today, but keep in mind this is a conversation that is reflected almost in an exact mirror by the Fed's activity. And Stockman just this last week said, this is why the current monetary system is so profoundly wrong. We have this character, Rosengren, up in Boston. This is a quote of, from David Stockman, saying that it's a good thing that we're trying to induce people to go into risk assets. Stockman says, who the hell is Rosengren to tell old ladies in America that they have to buy junk bonds because the Fed tells them to? If the old ladies feel safer in a CD, they ought to be able to earn something besides dog food money on it. There's going to be a revolt against these arrogant mandarins running the Fed. They will rue the day they arrogated to themselves such massive power. And again, it's not just the Fed. It's the Bank of England. It's the Bank of Japan. It's the ECB, all acting in unison and doing the same kinds of things, looking at the Fed's activity the last several years and saying, work for them, maybe to work for us.
Well, and David, I mean, even above the central banks, you know, we have people who are supposed to be regulating and watching out for the world, you know, the BIS, the IMF, you know, Lagarde. I think she's loving this inflation.
She is. I mean, she said of the Bank of Japan's actions this last week, this is a fantastic step. She says that loose monetary policies and unconventional measures by the world central banks are in fact boosting global growth.
Is that really happening?
Really? Like in China? Like in Europe? I mean, the U.S.? I mean, we've already talked about the seasonal adjustments which improved first quarter numbers in the U.S. Take those away. Where are we going now? I'd like to see Christine Lagarde's response to declining economic statistics as we move into the second, third, and fourth quarters of the year and see if she still feels like money printing is stimulating growth in the global economy. I quote her here. She says, the reforms just announced by the Bank of Japan are a welcome step in this direction, again, towards boosting global growth. And we mentioned this last week. U.S. figures are positive because of seasonal adjustments. They have exaggerated the stats higher, and that, of course, gets sucked out for the rest of the year via negative seasonal adjustments.
Well, David, you were talking about you'd like to hear her response. Actually, what I would like to do is hear your response to her. I mean, what would you say to her if you could talk to her right now?
I guess I'm comforted to know that the key ingredient for economic growth is money printing. I was under some grand illusion that real things had to be invented and produced and distributed and sold. I mean, I was under the impression that money was both a store of value as well as a medium of exchange. And now, thank you, Ms. Lagarde, and our cohort of world central bankers, now I see that you can do so much if you eliminate the quote-unquote store of value
right.
from the
money.
Definition of money and use it instead just as a means of exchange for goods.
Well, you know, David, we've seen this really not work in Europe in the past, and we can go back almost 300 years to see the first incident of just complete destruction of a monetary system.
Sure. John Law would be proud of her, and the central bankers of our day would be too. This is very progressive thinking. You don't need money as a store of value. It is sufficient for it to be a medium of exchange, and thus increasing its supply helps you, helps the business, helps the world economy, because again, it doesn't have to be a store of value. That, of course, flies in the face of history, which would say money, real money, has to be a store of value. Otherwise, the vicissitudes of the market, the risk that's in the market, and what anyone has done with a fiat currency will ultimately be destructive to an economy via the destruction of that currency.
Well, and we are not a closed system. Okay, so when Japan decides to double their monetary base, the Chinese have to respond in kind, or their imports all of a sudden get out of whack. So it's a race to the bottom.
Lo and behold, their foreign exchange regulator this week says, wait a minute, you know, this is really going to have beggar thy neighbor effects. If you're lowering the value of the yen, we either have to do the same thing or deal with a reduction in exports because we're no longer competitive in terms of our electronics, et cetera, et cetera. So now you have the opportunity for intense trade disputes, and you have the possibility of yuan devaluation, which then what do you do if you're managing the Vietnamese currency?
Right.
Okay, well, if the Chinese are devaluing because the yen is devaluing, we must devalue. And so it sets across a domino effect, a competitive currency devaluation. And this is where I think Lagarde and others are losing the forest for the trees on this issue. You've got super quantitative easing, which carries an implicit devaluation with it, and others must respond or lose market share in exports. They're not willing to lose their political legacy by having more people unemployed because they somehow had a reduced slice of the export pie.
Well, and David, this really is just a desperate move to keep this thing together. You know, the Economist magazine, which is out of Europe, out of England, actually, discusses easy money this week. It's got a full special report on it. And basically what it's saying is we've had 4 or 5 years of very substantial easy money policies. We're really not seeing the growth.
It hasn't led to global economic growth. In spite of what Lagarde is suggesting, it's simply not there. The numbers don't support it. Now, I mean, speaking of the numbers not supporting it, let's come back across the pond to the U.S.
Right.
Last week's unemployment numbers were awful. Not just bad, but terrible. The irony was, of course, that U3, the most popular measure of unemployment, dropped from 7.7 to 7.6. So there is an apparent improvement in the employment numbers. Meanwhile, everything about it was rotten, just
right.
Stinky.
Well, David, they're changing the size of the labor force every time they do a calculation. I mean, if the number of people actually in the labor force is decreased first before you figure out what your increase is going to look like it's better.
Well, exactly. So your total labor market, if you have people who are leaving the labor market, the percentage who are unemployed in the labor market does improve on the basis of those who are no longer in the labor market. So you had 500,000 plus that left the labor force. Yeah, unemployed as a percentage of total labor force. Again, let's just look at this. This to me is one of the reasons why U3 is just an absolutely worthless number. You have the unemployed as a percentage of the total labor force. If the labor force declines, then the number improves. Ergo, if 10 million people left the labor force, we should see a dramatic improvement in the employment figure.
Right.
Now, I mean, again, it's an absolutely worthless statistic. So your labor force participation rate is now at a level we haven't seen since 1979. In other words, there's less people in the economy. Why does that ultimately matter? Well, think about some of our long-term issues. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, these are the issues which, along with defense, are unaffordable for us moving forward. We don't have enough revenues to deal with the expenses which we anticipate. What Lawrence Kotlikoff has penned up as a $220 trillion funding gap, the difference between our expected revenues and the expected outflows, again, we have that many less people in the economy generating revenues and generating, you know, productivity by which we can then pay those bills. So, you know, this is kind of, again, it's a sick inconsistency where we can see the unemployment number improve, but the economy can actually be declining at the same time.
Right. So, you know, if you're, let's just use an example. Let's say that you're using a base of 100 and you use a reference of 10 to that. Well, that's 10%. But if you reduce your base to 50, all of a sudden 10 represents 20%. So you're increasing the amount of the way the percentage pays off, but actually you're not increasing workers, Dave. We're shrinking.
Right.
That's the bottom line of what you're saying here.
Well, and many would argue that where you're really seeing a reduction in the labor force is with those who are retiring, that it's retirees who are simply saying, hey, been there, done that, time to go play golf or shuck pecans on the front porch or what have you. But what is it that's actually happening?
It's discouraged workers.
It is discouraged workers. We can't make sense of it being retirees because the fastest growing demographic in terms of jobs growth has been in the age bracket between 55 and 75.
They're having to go back to work, Dave.
Well, they wanted to retire, and this is the sad reality. Those who would like to retire can't afford to, or they're strategically putting it off for a few years. Now, in the latter case, we think that's wise. But honestly, we see far too many cases where retirement occurs too early and with too little in resources.
Well, David, a big part of that is the low interest rates that are being paid. I mean, we've talked before about people who retired 20 years ago who could expect maybe 5, 7, 8% on their money. They could save a certain amount of money and actually live on the fixed return from that investment.
But it's not just the households that are seeing that distortion. The same distortion is occurring amongst CFOs and amongst your big Fortune 500 companies. You've got corporate executives who are wise enough right now to finance at these ridiculously low rates. And what they're doing is they're playing the game, in many instances, they're playing the game of buying back shares.
Right.
With the money that they're borrowing.
With cheap money.
Right. I mean, this last week we had Walmart borrow $5 billion. Now, I don't know exactly how they're going to use it, but many corporations have taken the borrowings at historically low rates and gone ahead and retired equity. Now, this is a game, I say it's a game, because when you reduce the shares outstanding, this is kind of sleight of hand to improve your earnings per shares number. You've reduced the shares outstanding, and thus your earnings for a given quarter divided by a smaller number of shares shows up as an increased or improved earnings per share number.
We talked about that last week. The price earnings ratio is so critical. And you talked about how the price earnings ratio in the stock market right now is getting toppy. It's getting up to a point where possibly the stock market would come back down. But an executive can actually reduce the number of shares by borrowing money, cheap money, buying shares, reducing the amount of shares outstanding. And it, what that does is it makes the earnings look better per share.
Right. So when you get to an earnings report and you say, well, from last quarter, from last year, so we've quarter on quarter, month on month, year on year, things are improving. What do we really have to look at? You have to look at the liability side of the balance sheet and see if they're in fact growing their liabilities, growing their debts. At the same time, their earnings per share is improving. To see what, again, how are they gaming the system? That's really what we're talking about.
Well, and David, I'd like to shift back then to gold, because that's what we're talking about here. We're seeing gaming of the system. We're seeing quantitative easing. We're seeing printing. We're seeing artificial interest rates. We're seeing a system right now that's being manipulated by those who would try to persuade us that everything's fine. Yet we're also seeing manipulations in the gold market. I mean, I come in Monday morning this week, just like every other Monday morning, it seems. The gold market seemed to be doing fine, and then boom, somebody came in and knocked it down again.
Monday morning smackdown. I mean, it's an amazing thing to see the handoff from Europe to the U.S. and the negative bias, which we've discussed before,
right,
in the New York markets for gold. Now, it's at this point axiomatic that central bankers need to cover the consequences of the liquidity they're creating. And if they can, along with the help of a George Soros or whoever else is going to ring the bells and capture the print headlines, that no, gold is a worthless item, you don't need it, silver is not something that you should have, there is no defense against volatility in the equity markets or the bond markets or the currency markets, except buying more treasuries, perhaps. I mean, there's some really confusing themes that are coming through the news headlines. And I'd say if you cut through all of that garbage, you have central bank balance sheets, which are expanding.
Right.
And you have the price of gold, which is moving in lockstep with it. Now, we've had very little central bank balance sheet expansion in aggregate over the last 18 months. And lo and behold, the price of gold hasn't gone anywhere. And it is back in the mode, that is balance sheet expansion. The central banks of the world saying, well, we've got to continue to print. Bank of Japan, England, U.S., ECB, in aggregate, we're beginning to see that increase again.
So for the person who owns gold or is buying more gold, what you're saying is that's not going to change. As much money as they print, that's how much gold will go up.
Our currency of choice, which would be gold, will reflect dollar weakness, yen weakness, euro weakness as a result of that money printing.
Yeah, that's amazing, Dave. It's like what we were talking about before. We can look at gold in dollar terms and say, well, gosh, what a week. It really didn't do much. But in yen terms,
it was doing just fine, and it's moving back towards its all-time highs. Now, the question in terms of the U.S. equity markets and our financial system as a whole, there is, in our opinion, a lot of rottenness in the system at the core, and deterioration in terms of, you know, deteriorating earnings. The quality of earnings is beginning to slip. What is the trigger that would have us sort of replay a 2007-2008, or rather a 2008-2009 debacle?
Well, that's a question that I've had a lot of clients asking. They're watching and they're saying, gosh, should I go back into the equities market? My old broker, who granted lost me a lot of money in 2008, he's calling me and he's saying, hey, I'm making money now.
And I would say that, you know, you should be reading the market. You know how you go to a theme park and you've got the sign before those big roller coasters that say, you know, if you have a heart condition, you should avoid this ride.
Right.
You know, it's kind of their disclosure, a CYA, if you will,
right,
for you shouldn't be on this ride if you have heart palpitations or, you know, just gotten out of a major surgery. Well, that's what I think we can expect. The ride for 2013 and 2014 in the U.S. equity markets is not for the faint of heart. And, you know, what is the trigger for lower prices? I don't think it even matters. I mean, this is, we're living in the mountains here in Colorado. When I did my avalanche trading up in Silverton, we were taught that anything can be a trigger. You dig your pit, and you figure out what the stability conditions are. What are the levels of snow? What levels create instability? And if the environment is bad, if the environment is unstable, then go home. Go
right.
home. Don't play. Because you could be the trigger. A bird flying overhead could be the trigger. A pine cone falling from the tree could be a trigger. The next valley over could be a snowmobiler coming, just ripping through the bottom of the valley, and you could be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, David,
that's what it feels like to us.
That's a great analogy. You know, tragically, a couple of weeks ago, someone my son and daughter went to school with was lost. Very big name in the community. He was a backcountry skier, young guy, 22-year-old guy. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, but the conditions were that he should not have been there in the first place. Not trying to figure out what would trigger it, but just stay away from the environment.
Yeah, just this last week, Bloomberg reports the Bank of England saying equity prices do not reflect underlying economic situations. Mm. So what are they basically saying? Prices are too high given the amount of economic activity we see. I mean, that's a subtle way of saying be cautious. Be cautious, be very cautious.
So David, if you were to summarize what you're trying to say, this change that we're seeing, not only with Japan but worldwide, what would you say?
Inflation is here on a global basis. The new normal is nothing more, nothing less than the extraordinary experimental policies of the Fed. They've been rationalized, and now they're being employed all over the world. And the new normal is one of radical measures which have been taken, which inadvertently have destroyed the capital allocation process, which normally the market directs. Now, what are the consequences? The consequences are that you have asset bubbles. The consequences are that you have reinforced systemic frailties, even while everyone is glad-handing and patting themselves on the back for creating what they believe to be a market normal condition. In fact, it's abnormal. In fact, it's unhealthy. In fact, it's very dangerous. And the end of April, beginning of May, may be the transition point to a very scary time in terms of the markets and a recognition that the economy globally is not, in fact, in recovery.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or just give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.